It's a question that shouldn't come with a punchline. But this is mid-90s Chelsea, so naturally, it does. The question? How do you sign a Ballon d'Or winner? And the answer? Get him drunk.
We didn't let Ruud go anywhere near the stadium or the training ground, because even though we'd upgraded the training ground, it still wasn't anywhere near like Milan or anything that he would have been used to. So, yeah, I kept him away from there and ended up taking him down the King's Road for a bit of lunch and a couple of bottles of wine and got him to sign.
From Highway 61, this is The Blueprint. I'm Kerry Levy, and together with Chelsea insider Gary Hayes, we've spent over 8 years piecing together the club's modern story. We're taking listeners inside Chelsea like never before, as the key people who transformed the club's fortunes talk us through just how they did it, changing the English game forever. And this included Chelsea's role in the free transfer market, being the first Premier League club to really understand the potential to manipulate it in the mid-90s. Signing players that should have been well out of their reach, such as Dutch legend Ruud Gullit. But how?
We were pioneers, really, in the Bosman era. I mean, obviously Ruud came on a Bosman, a free transfer. Later, Gianluca Vialli was a Bosman. In 97, Gus Poyet came from Zaragoza on a Bosman.
It's an incredible list of players who have all written their names into Chelsea folklore. And it was thanks to the Bosman ruling that they were able to become Chelsea players at all. Ah yes, the Bosman ruling. We touched upon this in episode 2 of The Blueprint. Remember the Marriott Accord? Glenn Hoddle, Ken Bates, Matthew Harding and Colin Hutchinson all sat round a table in a Marriott hotel mapping out Chelsea's future? Well, that was Hutchinson talking just now. And he was the man who had helped mastermind Chelsea's new plan, which was to sign world-renowned talent for nothing, transforming the look of Chelsea's squad. It would mean a change of emphasis. It would mean the club fighting for European football, not fighting to avoid relegation. So here's the background. Jean-Marc Bosman was a Belgian midfielder born in Liège, where he played for much of his career. First for Standard Liège and then RFC Liège. He was a top-flight professional, but in terms of legacy, it's safe to say Bosman's name wouldn't have been known to many beyond the borders of his homeland. Until he found himself in a dispute with RFC, that is. It was 1990 and his contract was expiring. Bosman wanted to join Dunkirk, just across the Belgian border in France, and he was under the impression he could do so without a transfer fee. But RFC refused to sanction the move unless Dunkirk paid them around £500,000. You heard that right. Even though Bosman was out of contract, RFC was still demanding a fee for his transfer. Well, Dunkirk didn't want to pay, and Bosman was caught in the middle of it all. It led to an almighty legal battle between the club and player that lasted 5 years, during which time Bosman barely played, entering his 30s with the best days of his career behind him by the time everything was settled. Bosman did win the case, however, changing the transfer market overnight. The ruling was simple and etched into European law. When a player's contract expired, he was free to move to any club he wanted without a fee being paid. And that's the Bosman ruling. It's allowed clubs such as Chelsea to use it to their advantage ever since. And in 1995, it meant the Blues were suddenly operating in a different market when it came to transfers. From scrapping around in English football, they were suddenly signing superstars.
Ruud Gullit's arrival was a big statement. I mean, this is somebody who was a massive figure around the world of football, European Football of the Year and more.
Martin Tyler has been the voice of the Premier League since the top flight of English football rebranded itself. He was the main commentator for Sky Sports in the league's inaugural season and is still present in the TV gantry today. So he knows a thing or two about those players who arrived in England and changed the game. And Tyler saw Gullit as the trailblazer that he was.
The other thing to remember about those times, of course, is that the foreign invasion, if you want to call it that, was only gradually happening. I mean, the first Premier League season, there were very few foreigners. And gradually, as more and more money came into the game through, obviously, my business through television, it widened the net. And there were other rules that had to be changed as well, with the PFA and the government about work permits and how people were perceived as coming to enhance our game or just taking jobs from the English professionals. So all that had to be worked through as well. But Ruud was somebody that, you know, when you walk, if he walks into a room you're in, you know he's about. He's got great presence, obviously a fantastic footballer, and somebody who grasped the opportunity. Clearly a very good English speaker, so not all the foreign invasion were like that. There was a feeling, I think, how much football that he got in him still after a wonderful career. But he certainly had some to offer. And he seemed to fit in well. Ruud talks very fondly about his time with Chelsea and going off to the races with the players on the day off and generally embracing the culture of the dressing room. And that it was perhaps something he hadn't experienced before, whether in the end, in management, that was more difficult to deal with. But certainly as a player, I think he had a great feel for it. He still had a great feel for the ball. And yeah, it was special. It was special when you announced him as on the team lineups. You know, it wasn't something that you really anticipated was going to happen.
But in 1995, top quality foreign players were coming to England, joining Chelsea of all teams. The Blues were leading the way in this new transfer frontier, and supporters loved it.
So signing Ruud Gullit really was a pivotal moment, I think.
Andy Saunders is one of the voices on the popular podcast The Chels. He's a lifelong Chelsea fan who sits in the West Stand at Stamford Bridge with his sons Harry and Joel.
Most Chelsea fans of a certain vintage can remember where they were when we signed Ruud Gullit. Here was a global superstar, an AC Milan superstar, you know, a Dutch superstar coming to our club. You know, a charismatic, foreign, exotic player coming along to play for us. You know, and everybody with their Ruud Gullit dreadlock wigs walking down the Fulham Road, and it just seemed like a remarkable, bizarre thing to do to sign him.
Chelsea fan and author Tim Rowles is another one of those who is pinching himself at Hullet's arrival.
Obviously, Gullit coming in was an enormous game changer. I think that made not just our supporters, but every supporter and the media and everyone in football sit up and think, wait, Gullit is one of the very, very best players in world football over the last 10, 15 years. And he signed for Chelsea. You know, a Chelsea side that Hoddle had changed, but he hadn't transformed because he didn't have the players to do it. But Gullit was definitely a transformational signing.
It was dream come true stuff.
When I saw Ruud Gullit play on television in the 1988 Euros and the 1990 World Cup, you thought, what a fantastic player, and you'd see the odd European Cup game on television. So when it appeared in the paper that Chelsea had bought Ruud Gullit, who was probably one of, along with Maradona, the highest profile player in the world, that was just truly astonishing. It was. We'd had stories in the 70s planted in the papers that we were going to buy Kevin Keegan when he was European Footballer of the Year. Well, clearly we weren't, because we were skint and we just sold Ray Wilkins. So I think initially people didn't believe it because it was so left field that a man of Hullet's stature could come to a club like Chelsea. But fair play to Ken Bates, to Glenn Hoddle and to Colin Hutchinson. Somehow, they did the deal and persuaded him to come. And that changed so much.
And we'll explain just how Hoddle and Hutchinson convinced Gullit to join Chelsea after this short break.
Hi everyone, this is Alison Bender and I hope you're enjoying listening to The Blueprint and the story of Chelsea's rise to success. You'll be hearing from me a little bit later on in the series as I share some of my memories of working inside the club with stories of my time at the training ground with the likes of Jose Mourinho and John Terry. If you'd like to hear more anecdotes and insight from journalists like me, then why not listen to my own podcast, Talent Takes Time? It's an in-depth look inside sports media, speaking with journalists who've overcome all sorts of challenges to achieve success. The series is streaming right now wherever you get your podcasts, and it's produced by Highway 61, the same people who produced The Blueprint. So just search for Talent Takes Time wherever you get your podcasts and have a listen. And if you're chasing your own career in the media, there is plenty of help and advice to guide you on your way. Now, let's get back to The Blueprint.
Before we get into the arrival of Hullett and how his signing was secured, it's important to analyse the dynamic between Ken Bates and Matthew Harding, the chairman and vice chairman whose support was essential to realising the ambitious plans of Hoddle and Hutchinson. But it wasn't that simple. On one side, there was the pragmatic, authoritarian Ken Bates, the owner who had saved Chelsea from ruin and wanted to ensure the club remained stable financially. And on the other side was the younger, effervescent Matthew Harding, who had come on board with the club after investing his own money to help restore some glamour at Stamford Bridge. Bates and Harding wanted to achieve the same thing for Chelsea, to awaken the sleeping giant and have the Blues competing at the highest level. At times, they didn't see eye to eye, and in football parlance, couldn't always agree on the best tactics for how to score a goal.
The thing is, I think that the problem there slightly was there was a bit of a clash between Ken and Matthew, because Matthew wanted to really take it on. But I think he felt, I've always felt, if he'd become chairman, he would put the money in long before it actually did arrive at Chelsea. But I think Matthew saw the vision. He saw Chelsea coming back, and that's why he wanted to get on board again. So there was always this this going on a little bit. I think Ken saw me because I was younger and closer to Matthew's age, and Matthew would always call me up and he loved spending time around the players and being with us in the training ground or travelling and stuff like that. And he'd call me up and say, I need a lunch. Come on, we're going for lunch. I said, look, I've got training in the afternoon. I want to listen to your vision. And it'd be a liquid lunch and it'd be one of those. So I think, he loved Chelsea through and through, Matthew. So there was this, all this was going on a little bit behind the scenes. And I think Ken resented that I had no allegiances to Matthew or Ken. I was Chelsea manager. There was a bit of politics going on. And I think that's where there was this, Colin was quite strong. He knew where I wanted to go and what I wanted to do with this team. And didn't quite feel that the ambition was there at the same time. I think it would have been if Matthew had been at the helm.
Regardless of how ambitious Chelsea were, just as the club was taking strides forward, it seemed Bates and Harding became ever more divided, as Neil Barnett explains.
It was a time when the club felt it was going forward very strongly, but it was already a division, if you like, between manager and chairman, because I think we came 14th in the league that season, and it just wasn't an improvement. It wasn't the improvement that the chairman was looking for. And we didn't have a lot of money to spend because of the battle to save Stamford Bridge and to keep Chelsea at Stamford Bridge, which was taking up all the resources. And of course, I think it was during that season that Matthew Harding came on the scene and said, well, let's spend a bit of money. I've got money. Let's spend a bit of money. And while that became a possibility, it also became a bit of aggravation at board level after he joined the board. So it was a club that was being torn in several directions at the time.
Known as Spy in some Chelsea quarters, Barnett's connection with Chelsea goes back to before the Premier League. He worked at the training ground as a club reporter, writing for Bridge News and recording stories for the old club call telephone service. Living up to his Spy moniker, he witnessed plenty behind closed doors.
I think that Matthew was willing to back Glenn to the hilt, whereas Ken Bates was determined to win the war of the property. It was never too clear exactly what the possibilities were, but yes, Glenn was close to Matthew, and no, he wasn't close to Ken. However, one way or another, through the walls, through Matthew being banished to back to the North Stand, the Matthew Harding Stand, everything sorted itself out bit by bit.
Matthew Harding and Ken Bates met through happenstance, really.
That's another voice from our previous episodes, Chelsea's official historian, Rick Glanville.
Matthew Harding saw that Ken Bates was calling for investors to come into the club, and as a lifelong fan, he made contact, and Ken Bates rang him up. His opening gambit was something along the lines of, "Hello, I understand you think you're wealthier than I am. I'm ringing up just to check that that's right." So it was a typical sort of abrasive opening line from Ken Bates, who was the master of that punch first and shake hands later. But they got on well enough initially for Harding to throw tens of millions into the club to help build the parts of the stadium and to underpin the restructuring of the playing side of things as well.
Harding was an influence behind the scenes. He got on very well with Hoddle.
And that's Kings of the Kings Road author Clive Batty.
Ken Bates, on the hand, was more interested in developing the ground, one felt. He saw that as the priority. Obviously, he wanted a better team, but his prime concern was more the long-term establishment of Chelsea at Stamford Bridge with essentially a new ground, because it had to be redeveloped after the Hillsborough disaster. So that took a number of years. So it was a long-term project, really, to get Chelsea into a better position. There was such a lot of work to do, both on and off the pitch. Almost revolution, really, what was going on there.
But these were two chalk and cheese, really, as in terms of personalities. Matthew, who's a lifelong Chelsea fan and a multimillionaire and really a champagne socialist, someone who was never happier than holding court in a pub before the game and shouting out statistics or, you know, sort of chanting and singing his stuff. And then he'd go off to the game and, like some reverse Superman, he'd go into the toilets there, put on a suit and go up into the director's box and watch the game. But he would have been, he much preferred being amongst the lads in the, what was then the at the time, the North Stand, and letting himself go with his Chelsea shirt on, celebrating, punching the air, singing all the songs. And he was obviously a different generation to Ken Bates, different politics, different outlook on life. Both shared an irreverence, which perhaps was a connection that they enjoyed. But I think what happened to create the schism was that Bates felt Harding was briefing against him and that he wanted to be chairman in Ken Bates' place and that he was going about it in a quite underhand way. That's how Ken Bates saw it. And so once it had become a political battle, the incumbent was always going to be the winner. And from being the deputy chairman and, in fact, chairman in waiting, Matthew Harding stood down from a post on Chelsea Village because he was asking difficult questions about who the investors were in that, and then the two just sort of warily paced around each other after that. And it was terrible to see as a supporter, just when it looked like we were getting back on track, to see these two protagonists prowling around each other and having public spats was a really unedifying thing to see.
As the managing director at the time, Colin Hutchinson had to appease Bates and Harding too.
Well, I was the one in the middle. My sole focus was the football club, and to be between them at times was very difficult, but I just got on with it. I made what I felt were the right decisions for the football club. In their own ways, they both wanted Chelsea to be successful, but on some points, they couldn't agree.
To suggest the Bates and Harding relationship was fraught is an understatement. And Hoddle's closeness with Harding did frustrate Bates, as the former owner explains.
But obviously, he'd sucked up to him in some way or the other, because Hoddle was close to him. And Hoddle introduced his lady amour, sorry, what do you call those? Soothsayers, faith healers and future forecasters or whatever is a name for them, but I can't remember. And Matthew was completely under her spell. Oh, Matthew tried everything. He put private eyes on me.
Bates goes further to suggest the tension between Harding and himself held up the club's progress significantly.
I've had a battle all my life in various, do whatever I've done, I've finished up. So just sharpen sharpen the knife edge. He thought he was a street fighter, but I was a street fighter. No, I knew he wasn't going to win. To maybe more irritated, more angry, because he was diverting Chelsea's growth. He put Chelsea back 5 years, at least. When you're running a football club, there's always diversions and energies and people trying to have a poke at you. He thought he was the first. And he thought, now what, some of the things you could do in the city, you could do in the strip back streets, and you can't.
But this is tabloid fodder, and we want to take the Chelsea story on a different path, to focus on something more positive and impactful. It's an injustice to Chelsea if we maintain focus on that so-called battle for Stamford Bridge. Indeed, it takes away from what Bates and Harding achieved for the club individually and collectively, suggesting their lasting legacy was a squabble played out in the Red Tops, which it isn't. Bates and Harding were incredible figures for Chelsea, both involved in something all the more important at Stamford Bridge. Something much less scurrilous and more exciting. Chelsea was starting to realise their potential on the pitch. And when it came down to it, despite all the negative headlines, that's all anyone ever really cared about.
I will always remember Glenn Hoddle as the beginning of the revolution. I will remember Ken Bates as the man who brought a life to the club that involved some of the best football we've ever played. And I will remember Matthew Harding as bringing a kick in the backside to the club that helped jettison us into the new era.
And Bosman was a big part of that new era, for which Hoddle and Hutchinson had a plan. Chelsea had qualified for the Cup Winners' Cup in 1994 after reaching the FA Cup final.
We lost that, of course, 4-0. David Ellery gave United 2 penalties, but as runners-up, we got into the Cup Winners' Cup. And we had quite a good run in the Cup Winners' Cup, losing to Real Zaragoza in the semi-finals with Gus Poyet in their team. And that meant that we had had a European experience.
Chelsea in Europe, that was unheard of at that time. So, and we did unbelievable to get through to the semis. We really did with that, with the team as it was. And it was, again, it was all about, I could see the stepping stones of where Chelsea could go, where it could unfold eventually. And we were on the right path. We were on the up. And, yeah, it was enjoyable, but bloody hard work.
And having had the taste of Europe, it felt a little bit downcast that we wouldn't have Europe the following season.
That's because the Blues had finished 11th in the Premier League in 95, and with no silverware to their name, Europe wasn't a possibility.
So Glenn and I then worked on a strategy to try and shape a better future for the club and attracting better players. And the philosophy of that was that we couldn't compete financially or on pulling power with the Manchester Uniteds, the Liverpool, the Arsenals. So we would have to go for players in their late 20s. And also, I had an eye on a new ruling that was coming in called the Bosman transfer system, which meant that a player coming to the end of his contract could move without the club demanding a fee if his contract was expiring, which was totally new. So with this in mind, in May 95, we called a meeting at the Marriott Hotel at Langley, which has become known as the Marriott Accord in the years since. We went there on a Sunday morning, and at that meeting, there was Ken Bates, Matthew Harding, Glenn and myself. And from there, we decided to go forward with a policy of trying to attract better players and to try and start making a mark. So we felt that if we didn't start to make progress, we would be totally left behind with the advent of the Premier League.
Enter stage right, Ruud Gullit.
I heard that he was up on a free transfer. And I think Colin was taken aback, thinking, yeah, you got no chance, Glenn, but we'll go with you. I think it was that sort of attitude. Obviously, he fed it into Ken, and then, we let Matthew know, and we knew it was a free transfer, but we knew it was going to be quite hefty with, obviously his deal.
Ah, yes, the true expense of signing Gullit. What was it now? Remember, we did ask Colin Hutchinson.
That is a little bit near the mark for you to ask that, but I'm sure if you go back through your records, you might find it. It was in keeping with the prices for top stars at the time.
So maybe Glenn can tell us instead.
I can't remember.
Really?
I genuinely don't know, because in the end, that weren't my job. You know, if it was my job, you'd have my maths teacher at school would have been distraught to think that I had the purses at Chelsea.
As the saying goes, there's no such thing as a free lunch in football. So while Chelsea may not have been paying transfer fees for players, some money would have to be spent elsewhere.
You're spending on wages, as Alan Sugar said. Money now is like prune juice. I said, what do you mean, Alan? He said, goes in the top, comes out the bottom. That was the premise, because he was trying to put a limit on transfer fees at the Premier League. And I asked him, and it is like prune juice, I asked him what he meant. So he told the startled 18-member chairman, players got more interested. There were people, any form I ever heard. And it was the age of the agents, and it was the age of football becoming of interest to the media. And I actually think the TV contributed to that, because now the press had a lot more to write about.
Still, the Bosman ruling meant Ruud Gullit was coming to Chelsea for a fraction of the cost.
So at that meeting, we outlined our plans, and we also told Matthew and Ken Bates for the first time that there was a possibility we could sign Ruud Gullit and maybe Paul Gascoigne.
Paul Gascoigne was in the peak of his career in 1995. He was 28, lighting up Serie A with Lazio and widely celebrated as one of the most gifted players of his generation. A year later at Euro 96, Gazza would score one of the best goals ever witnessed inside Wembley Stadium. An audacious finish against Scotland to seal a memorable 2-0 victory for England.
When they picked themselves up off the floor, they decided that we should go for it. And Glenn and I then went out to Milan to meet Ruud Gullit, or try to meet him, and were confounded by a load of agents who all said they represented him. So we had some discussions and left it at that.
I did have a chuckle to myself, actually, because I thought when I mentioned it, I said, like, I want to go and get Ruud Gullit and play him sweeper. And I think he used to play sweeper when he was a kid. I played against him for Feyenoord. And I want to take him back there. He's got a bit of a dodgy knee, but, you know, I want to play him the three at the back, and I'm retired, so let's do it. And I think, you know, it was quite funny. It was like a wry smile. Well, it was almost like, well, yeah, if you think you can get him, Glenn, we'll back you, not thinking for one second that we were going to get him. And in the end, Colin and I are sitting in a fancy Milan hotel and waiting to see Rudy. Went over and saw him at the training ground. And after backwards and forwards and going this and that, and he came over to London, kept him away from the training ground and the stadium, fortunately.
Gullit was such a big star. His profile was arguably bigger than that of Chelsea at the time. It's a wonder if he ever knew Chelsea existed.
I don't think he had a clue. I think the fact that we got to the cup final the year before, that we're in Europe, I think that helped, that we'd played in Europe, and I think that helped. But he didn't know too much about Chelsea at that time, and we had to sell it to him quite hard.
And then we arranged a meeting, which this time only Ruud came to, again in Milan, and he said that he would give us a decision. This was around the Thursday. He would give us a decision on the following Monday, which was the bank holiday. Glenn was going on holiday, so the call came through to me from Ruud on the bank holiday Monday, saying yes, he would join us. So I sent a coded message, text, to Glenn to tell him that he was going to sign. The Thursday of that week, I went out to Genoa because Ruud was on loan from AC Milan to Sampdoria. Did all the paperwork. On the next lunchtime, he signed. And to show how technology was in those days, I rang Neil Barnett, who you well know from Chelsea Club Crawl days, and he got the exclusive interview of the signing from an hotel room where Rude had just signed his contract.
And Hutchinson hoped the next Club Call headline would involve Gazza.
Our travels in Italy weren't over, Glenn and I. We then flew out again to Rome to meet Paul Gascoigne, and we did. We had dinner with him and had a good chat, but chances of persuading him to come to Chelsea were never really on, because it was obvious that he'd decided to go to Glasgow Rangers.
The disappointment of missing out on Gazza would be short-lived for Hutchinson and Hoddle, though. Hullet was coming, and it was huge for Chelsea. Oh, the things a few drinks can deliver in life.
And that was really putting a marker down. I mean, I've had so many Chelsea people come up to me over the years and say, you know what, even now, with what they've done, he said, a lot of fans of a different age group say, that was the most, when I heard that on the radio, it was the most incredible feeling that, and so many have said the same thing, this can't be true. You know, Ruud Gullit is coming to sign for Chelsea. And it was like a pattern, you know, and I didn't like to tell him that I felt the same as well. But no, it was great, it was great. And Ruud was fabulous. He was a great player, and he wasn't at his top, top best, as I, you know, he had a slight knee, which I'd gone through myself. I knew what he, but he was a great character as well, great lad. And he really did make himself just one of the lads for the boys. It was a coup, wasn't it? At the time, it was a massive coup.
So the work of Hutchinson and Hoddle was done. Chelsea had their man. As they've each explained, Hutchinson and Hoddle had wheeled and dealed their way to bringing a Ballon d'Or winner, an actual generational talent, to West London. Years later, Hullet opened up to Chelsea TV about the experience of it all.
I think it was a feeling also with Glenn Hoddle. I think I admired him also as a player. And also what he was trying to do with Chelsea. I didn't know what it was in Chelsea. I had no clue whatsoever. But I had a good feeling with him. And I had some information about where Chelsea was and how London was. And it was also, for me, an important turn in my life. I wanted to have my life back. That meant that at the moment I was in Italy, everybody was, you know, on me, and popular, and hard to have an own life. And therefore, when I made that choice, I thought, okay, I go into something totally different. I like the English mentality, almost similar with the Dutch. So let's see what happens then. The shock came when I came here for the first time on the bridge, because the old stand, the West Stand, was still there, and both behind the goals was nothing there. So I said, what the hell is this? It was two holes, big holes, nice pitch, and that was the first shock. And I said, what is this? But I knew that I was, when I came first time in London, I had a good feeling. You know, and that is, I think that is something that you have to follow. I felt like a boy again. You must realize that when I played in Italy, in Milan, that was hard work. That was pressure every game. It was like if you had a draw, then hell broke loose. Everybody was screaming and chatting and meetings and everything. So I was under pressure all the time. And I remember one of the first games that I think we lost or we drew. And then the coach said, okay, bad luck, next time better. And I was like, bad luck. I said, oh, it was the first time I was like, oh, that's a relief, you know. It was like there was no pressure. And therefore, I could, I think, enjoy the game even more, because the English game suited me also. But also the appreciation around it. And that everything what you'd done and what you wanted to do was good in the eyes of the fans and also of your own players. So it was like playing on a schoolyard. I remember that Kevin Peacock came to me in a game. He said, look, Ruud, how is it possible? You always unmarked. How you do that? And I said, no, it's just the fact that you understand the game. It's also your experience of the game that you know where it's crowded. You don't have to be. You have to be somewhere else. You have to think two steps ahead, and therefore, if you go in that position, the ball will come automatically there. And it was nice also to explain these things to the players.
In 2 years, Chelsea had achieved so much. The change wasn't reflected in the trophy cabinet, but one need only look at the receipts to see it all laid out. Chelsea had one of England's brightest young managers in Glenn Hoddle. They had reached an FA Cup final, brought European football back to the King's Road. And now, Ruud Gullit had joined them. And to cap it all, Hoddle was no longer negotiating transfer deals on a broken payphone at the training ground either. He now had his own office. That's progress.
When Chelsea signed Gullit, it was like he was the most charismatic player, high-profile player we'd probably almost ever had, but certainly since the days of Osgood and Hudson. We had a man who looked the part, who could play football, who could read football, who was articulate. He must have been a dream for the media because he was so articulate, so intelligent talking about football, as was Hoddle to a degree. But Gullit was just, he was like a new man. You compared him with most of the players at most of the clubs in the Premiership. And everyone took notes, not just Chelsea supporters, supporters of every club. He was the media frenzy when he came in. All the other clubs must have been saying, why didn't we go for him? Man United, Liverpool, Arsenal must have been thinking, why didn't we get him? How did we let him go to Chelsea? And that's the first signing we'd made for a long, long time that would have elicited those emotions in the other top clubs.
But Ruud Gullit was good for Chelsea. There was still this feeling that the club was fighting the financial difficulties, and that in the end, I mean, Chelsea for me has always been a club closest aligned to the northern clubs because of the passion of the support of all the London clubs, I mean. And once the ground was squared off, I mean, for me, one of the biggest things that's happened in my time at Chelsea was the squaring off of the ground. As a kid, I'm a Woking fan, but when Woking weren't playing, when I was 10, 11 years old, I used to go to Stamford Bridge and stand beyond the track and peer across. And yeah, you could see, you know, viewing lines were pretty good, but it was still a bit of a bowl. And talking to players at that time and visiting players, they found it quite easy to play at Chelsea. Now, suddenly, with the ground being squared off, it wasn't easy anymore. And that kind of drive and determination from the supporters suddenly became a great factor for the team as well. So whichever individuals you want to throw at me, I think the squaring off of the ground has been one of the biggest things in Chelsea's development. And it's turned it into a proper bear pit, really, particularly for the visiting players. And it's certainly enhanced Chelsea's ability to win matches over the period where obviously other factors, the money's come in since then. But I do think that was a really big part in Chelsea's history. And it is a fantastic stadium to broadcast from because everything stays in there. Our commentary position is very high up now on the dressing room side of the ground, but it's still, you feel you're right in it. And that wasn't the case. That wasn't the case before.
Chelsea fans could step back and see the picture forming. They were supporting a different club now, one that was on the brink of exploding.
I take pride in the fact that I believe between 1993 and early 2000 ensured that someone with massive funds came in and took them to the ultimate level. But it's still nice, even though I've been left nearly 20 years now, that people recognise me and come up and say thank you for what you did for Chelsea.
Now, all Chelsea needed to do was to start winning things. That's next time on The Blueprint. If you've liked what you've heard already, please give us a 5-star rating and tell your friends about The Blueprint. The Blueprint has been written and produced by Gary Hayes and me, Kerry Levy. Our theme music, Blue Day 23, was composed by Mike Canaris, with bed arrangements by Jake Bradford Sharp, and is used under license from Macasso Music. Vocals are by The Blueprinters, Alison Bender, Chiara Cervazio, Karen Edith Miller, Louis Beneventi, Daniel Childs, and Gary and myself. Leon Rudzinski-Gorman has mixed the series, and Mark Jardine is our designer. Consultant producers for the series are Nick Lapworth, Neil Pacchietto, and Jackie Anklin. We would also like to thank Gary Link from The Missing Link, Taylor Hayes, and everyone who has spoken to us for this series, on and off the record. If you like this series, please share it with your friends and give us a 5-star rating wherever you listen to your podcasts. You've been listening to another Highway 61 production. For more podcasts like this one, visit www.highway61.media. That's HWY61.media.